13-25-00386-CV. Tony Merrick, is that how you pronounce it? Merrick?
Yes, Your Honor.
Versus Phi Theta Kappa Honor IT.
May it please the court. This appeal should really be focused on the merits, but I understand that my friends have raised an issue of of timing. And so we'll spend a little bit of time on that, unless Your Honors would like to advance me from that. If you'd be so kind as to just turn to or make note of page 19 of my friend's brief, they cite to Hill versus Kelly Hare. And I think that's a very nice case that they cited. They cite to it and it says, "Movement waives his motion to dismiss by failing to set the motion for a hearing within the statutory 90-day deadline." However, I'd like to turn your attention to the ellipses that they place there, where they remove the words, "use reasonable diligence to." So we waive the motion if we fail to use reasonable diligence to set the motion. And I think that the record shows, especially if you turn your attention to the third supplemental clerk's record, I think that the exchanges in that show full well that we did show not just reasonable diligence, but I might look back at the diligence I showed as being a little overly aggressive. We did our best. We set it within the time period. Then our friends insisted that it be moved forward. They insisted that it be moved forward for discovery. They insisted that there was no rush. They insisted that the case was over and that there was no need to do it right away. Now, all of this should be resolved by the fact that they waived this argument by not raising it below.
And Mr. Randazza, I was going to question that. I saw that in a reply briefing for Ms. Marek about the waiver argument, but let's just assume for the sake of argument that it could not be waived. Or is there case law in this arena particularly that supports that argument that you've made?
That
they can waive it.
I would say I'm arguing the general principle that if you do not raise something on appeal, you do not raise something below, you have waived it on appeal. And now here, there's actually a timing issue that I think makes that particularly poignant, because they are arguing that the final day was July 3rd, and they filed their brief on July 11th, so it's not like it's something that they would have been surprised by. So they not only waived it by not raising it below, but you know, I could see if maybe they had filed their brief 3 days before, in June, and they had said, well, this didn't come up, but well, it was up by then.
And, yes. And the court did, in fact, hear the case, didn't it? Was it by submission, or was there an actual hearing?
No, it was by submission, Justice Tierney.
They actually ruled on it. They actually ruled on the motion, the TCP or the fee motion.
Yes, Justice Tierney. So, and Justice Crone, also, if we were further addressing your question, there are five other reasons that I think that this issue is a non-starter, in addition to that, if we were to get hung up on the waiver. You will notice in the supplemental record, they were insisting that they wanted discovery. Now, we are looking at some very precise language here in the statute, and the statute says that if the court allows discovery, it does not say if it grants discovery. Now, I'm not the creative mind that came up with that argument. That credit goes to Justice Carlisle, and granted, he raised it in a dissent. However, his logic, I think, holds true, that the word allowed means to permit or fail to restrain or prevent. So as they were very hard, if you look at that record, you will see how hard they were hammering that they wanted discovery. The fact that they failed to take it is not my doing. That would extend the deadline to 120 days itself. And I think if the judge did not say no, the judge allowed it. The other question I'd like to look at for timing is the actual timing. What date is the operative date? Well, I'd say that, one, we filed the TCPA motion on April 4th, but we filed our fee motion on April 21st. So that would add a significant amount of time that would be well past this 90-day, well within this 90-day deadline. But I think the the more important arguments are that this is invited error. And when a party invites the error that they then try to rely upon, that is not going to save them from a TCPA motion. Additionally, most importantly, I think, is Merrick was not just diligent, but highly diligent. Every case that my friends cite that has this kind of strict timing issue, you have some action or inaction or error by the movant that causes the delay. In Grubbs, which I must express my dismay with the Grubbs decision, although it's not binding here, that in Grubbs, there was an agreement to extend the date so that they could be courteous and engage in mediation. I don't think anything in the statute supports that. But the fact is, if you look at that case, we have a strong distinguishment here that we did not agree. It was not any action of our part. We fought to have this done quickly. Brown versus Gordon, the same thing. The hearing was not even initially set in time. In re Giles, Mr. Giles participated in the delay. Hill versus Kelleher, as I started with, if you remove the ellipses and put the actual language of the case in that they cited, that supports us. And then in Walker versus Pegasus, that was an interesting one where the movant messed up serving the motion on the opposing party, which caused the hearing to have to be delayed. So error by them, agreement by them, in every circumstance where an appellate court has said it's just too late, it has been due to some doing or agreement or action by the movant. And then finally, the error itself is harmless. Because if you do the math, if you look at the calendar here, you have the TCPA motion filed. I don't think there's any argument that the court extended it to at least 90 days for its calendar purposes. The court said, we're going to put it on a date that's convenient for me. So then even if, by operation of law on July 3rd, that deadline had run, the court ruled by the 28th. So does it matter if there was no hearing at all that the court just said, this is my submission date? So there was no reason for anybody to be in a courtroom. There was nobody in a courtroom. So that decision was made on the 28th. We filed our notice of appeal on the 31st. So we are still within that 90 days, even on our notice of appeal. I'm sorry, the 90 days plus the 30 days that the court gets to rule upon the motion. So if your honors have any questions about this sub-issue, I would be thrilled to answer them. If not, I'd like to move on to the merits.
Go ahead. Yeah, I think we can.
Thank
we can
you.
Move to the merits.
Okay. Well, the merits. I think once we get there, we have even more clarity. Justice Tiarina, I know you're well aware of how the anti-SLAPP works. Your brief, your order in Greater McAllen Association of Realtors versus Wilkins.
Well, and my question, my biggest question regarding that is that how is this a matter of public concern?
PTK is a large national membership organization. So take that name out and substitute any other name. The Teamsters Union, the Democratic Party, the National Organization of Realtors. Any large membership organization that is involved in student politics, student affairs. I mean, these are millions of members.
But this is, more specifically, how is the email that's at the crux of a lot of this, how is that a matter of public concern? And I'll just, before you respond, let me go ahead and ask, and do secondarily, do we need to find that the email is a matter of public concern, that the information that was allegedly disclosed by employees who had signed NDAs, is that a matter of public concern? And then, in general, is the book itself? And if you can address that.
I think the book, certainly. The book is an expose on this organization. Now, I don't believe that it would be the correct analysis for an appellate court to now act as editor of the book and say, well, this particular information that you're news gathering itself is protected under the TCPA, under the Texas Constitution, and under the U.S. Constitution. We don't ask, is this interview important enough to be a matter of public concern? I represent plenty of journalists and authors that may have interviews that turn out to be worthless. That news gathering itself is still TCPA protected activity, and specifically so. And that is specifically protected in, the TCPA says, this chapter applies to a legal action against a person arising from any act of that person, whether public or private, related to the gathering, receiving, posting, or processing of information for communication to the public. I think it's up to the journalist or the author or the TV producer whether that information is important enough to include in their final product. I think once we have, does that sufficiently answer your question, Justice? Thank you. I think it's important for us to look at what the whole purpose of the TCPA is. I mean, this is, if you were sitting with the authors of the TCPA, I believe that this case itself would be such a perfect case study for them. This is somebody who was seeking to publish a book about a large national organization and a matter of public concern being not just sexual misconduct in the organization, but she's also discussing things like financial misconduct in the organization, malfeasance in the organization, the fact that the owner and her wife are self-dealing in the organization. I mean, this is all an expose that they sought to suppress because they didn't want it to come out on the day of their national conference. And to do that, they came into a courtroom and sought an ex parte injunction for a prior restraint. I mean, there is nothing more. when I litigate prior restraint cases all over the country, my first step is to Texas, because Kinney versus Barnes is the most illustrative case of that. In fact, I have a poster of it on my wall in my office in Massachusetts. Texas is the inspiration for intolerance of prior restraints, and that's exactly what this complaint sought. So, no matter how they want to color it, they say that this should not. Oh, I believe. Am I down to 2 minutes on my first round?
Yes.
All right. Well, I'm gonna take a rest here because I want to save some time for my rebuttal.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
May it please the court, Tracy Betts again for PTK. Your Honors, I want to start by addressing the issue of the Giles case, and in doing that, it's important to understand that this case was filed for one reason and one reason only, and that's because Ms. Merritt came into possession of attorney-client privilege emails that were discussing a case that was set to go to a jury trial in a federal district court in Mississippi in about a month or two. And so there was a need to act very quickly, which is exactly what this lawsuit is about and what it's always been about and why it's been filed as a declaratory judgment action and not some other tort, defamation, something like that.
Wasn't there more that was sought to be enjoined than just the email containing the attorney-client privilege?
Your Honor, what the request was at the trial, at the hearing, and what we repeatedly discussed at the hearing, was the fact that we needed the court to determine who had the right to possession of these materials, because that is what we wanted to ensure, that if she had them, they would come back to us because they are our attorney-client privilege information. That is what we were focusing on. And the petition itself has background information. There's a long history between these parties, 10 years of a very long history between these parties, of Ms. Merrick discussing what she is saying PTK has done wrong. And there has been no lawsuits filed ever once by PTK. It was when that email was publicly filed in a different case that PTK knew that she had come into the possession. And so the goal and the whole focus was, in fact, to shut that down.
Didn't the trial court ultimately deny the injunction, though? They granted your ex parte TRO, but then they ultimately, after this hearing, denied the injunction. Is that right?
That's correct. And we don't know why the trial court denied it. It could have been because the trial court felt that damages could make us whole. Could have been for other reasons, but we don't know that. And once that was denied, the whole issue, getting those back, determination of whether or not these are privileged, that became a non-issue for us, which is why there was a non-suit at that point. In discussing the timeliness of this motion, though, it is important for us to start with the Giles case because there was no waiver here. And Giles makes it very, very clear. And Giles is a published decision from this court that directly addresses the strict nature of the timing deadlines that are in the TCPA. And it is Merrick's burden on her motion to have it set for a hearing. And absent an intervening change in the law or an en banc hearing on that, Giles is the decision this panel is bound to follow, due to horizontal stare decisis. And it's interesting because we've got a lot of amici briefs in this case, and no one has found a case that says otherwise, that waiver exists. The Giles case says that it doesn't. In that decision, this court held that the TCPA's hearing deadline is mandatory, not discretionary, and it's not subject to waiver or invited error by the non-movement. And that case had facts that were far more extreme than what we're talking about here. And the court still found there was no waiver.
Well, let me, on the timing, of all of this when it happened, so there were some emails, I think, from Mr. Cullen and then yourself, I believe.
That's right.
That asked, saying that there was going to be a necessity for some sort of limited discovery. And so in that regard, it would have, under the statute and under the TCPA, would have extended the timeline. But in that regard, does the TCPA require that a trial court enter an order on discovery in order for that to kick in?
It does, Your Honor. Those emails were informal scheduling emails where the court was trying to determine what hearing date worked for everybody. It was summer. There was a lot of different schedules with vacations. In it, we said that we would be seeking limited discovery. My last words were actually potential discovery. But what's important to remember about the TCPA is the minute that a motion is filed under the statute, all discovery is stayed, all of it. And then we have this mechanism in the statute that allows for limited discovery if the court authorizes it. And the statute actually says if there is a motion by the party that's requesting it or on the court's own motion and for good cause shown. And so here, and I would like to raise, Your Honor, that this issue was not raised by Ms. Merrick in any of her briefing. They don't suggest until today that the 120-day deadline applied. In fact, in their briefing, they talk only about the 60 to 90-day deadline. So that issue is waived. I know that it's brought up in one of the briefs that were filed by amicus, but that issue was not raised by Ms. Merrick. But it shows that they didn't believe it applied, because in those email communications, they do oppose discovery. They do say, no, there's no need for discovery. They, in fact, say there's no good cause here even to extend it from 60 to 90 days, let alone even further for discovery. But it is true that it's required for the judge to take some sort of action, because we have under 27.003, discovery is automatically stayed. And then we have under 27.006, discovery may occur if the court authorizes it on motion and for good cause shown or on the court's own motion. That authorization is what eliminates the stay, at least to that limited part, and triggers that new 120-day deadline. So here, discovery was never authorized. PTK never filed a motion for discovery. The court never entered an order on discovery. The court never even actually mentioned it in the emails. In fact, the judge said, it was a mistake to try to get you guys to agree on a date. I'm going to set it for a date that's convenient for me. That's what the judge said. There's no even hint that that's being set for purposes of allowing discovery.
And going back to this argument set forth by Ms. Mark about waiver, that it was somehow waived because of the timing that PTK could have raised this timeliness issue in its response to the motion to dismiss. How do you respond to that?
I would say that the Giles Court says that's not required. And in fact, in that case, we had a hearing date that started within the statutory time period, and then it concluded outside of the statutory time period. And when the judge said, hey, we're going to need to move this to another date to complete it, the parties all entered into an agreement. And they said, this complies with the statutory requirements, and we're never going to say it doesn't. We're not going to make that argument that it doesn't. They never raised an objection with the trial court. In fact, they agreed it was okay. On appeal, and it was on a mandamus, they argued waiver because it was completed outside that 90-day period. And the court, this court, ruled there was no waiver. Even though the non-movement agreed to the new date, even though the non-movement entered into a stipulation, even though they said they weren't going to challenge it, they never objected at trial, none of that. And this court said the agreement doesn't matter because the statute doesn't allow the parties to agree to a date that goes beyond the mandatory statutory deadline. In fact, it said it, quote, expressly prohibits later hearing dates. So it said there was no waiver, even though it was never raised in the trial court. And then we go one step further, and that's the Walker case. And it's interesting because Ms. Merrick is relying on this Walker case's dissenting opinion to support her position. But what's important is the actual opinion of the Walker case. And that one's about invited error. And in that case, the court held that, quote, invited error doctrine does not apply. And in that case, it was the non-movement that asked for a continuance of the hearing outside the statutory time frame. At trial, at that hearing, the movement objected. And they said, no, that'll put us outside the statutory time period. That's a formal objection made on the record. And the court went ahead over the movement's objection and reset it for outside the 90-day time period. And then the non-movement, when it was finally heard, objected and said, this is too late. And the argument was invited error. The court said, quote, irrespective of who requested the hearing must be rescheduled, the statute mandates that the hearing must occur within the deadline specified therein. Accordingly, the invited error doctrine does not apply. And it's important with regard to the Giles case, which is the no waiver case, that case has actually been cited even just a month ago by another sister court in Texas for the proposition. And no one has ever said anything negative about the holding of the no waiver issue that is set forth in Giles. So you can't waive the hearing deadline mandates, and you can't invite error. And my colleague on the other side here is a national First Amendment litigator, and he clearly has many connections because we've seen a lot of amici brief in this case. And yet, even with that in fact, five extra eyes on this situation, no one has brought forth a case that distinguishes Giles or says it is wrong, because that is what the law is and the holding is, and that is what this court needs to follow. You cannot waive these statutory deadlines. And in fact, Ms. Merrick's counsel said that in his emails, but he never did anything. When the hearing, there was no agreement, no waiver, nothing, because when the hearing got set on May 21st, the court sent out a notice and said, I'm going to hear this on July 18th. Ms. Merrick had 43 days at that point before the deadline, the 90-day deadline ran. She had 43 days to do something. She didn't do anything. She didn't file an objection. She didn't ask the court to move the date. She didn't do anything. And in fact, that 90-day deadline came and ran, and that was the end of her TCPA motion at that point, because she had to have that hearing within the 90 days. And I think it's important to note, too, that the trial court didn't select the date that PTK asked. It didn't select the date that Ms. Merrick asked for. It said, I'm going to set it on something that's convenient for me. And presumably that's what the court did, because the dates requested by Ms. Merrick were in May and June, and the dates requested by PTK were in August, and he set it for July 18th. So that is what the evidence in this case is, and there's no evidence of any agreement between the parties. I will say really quickly with regard to the Hill case that diligence doesn't matter here. Ms. Merrick knows that it wasn't timely under the statute. They're not really arguing against that until today for the first time with this new 120-day argument. But instead, they're trying to rely on diligence. We pushed for it. We asked for it. It just wasn't granted. Well, first, she was diligent in the email, but it wasn't that diligent, because what do lawyers do if they want something on the record or they want to be heard on an issue is we file something in court. That's what's required of us under the trial rules. And saying something in an informal scheduling email with a judge, that doesn't cut it, because the TCPA has important mandatory deadlines, and you have to take action by filing something with the court. And that just did not happen. Second, diligence does not rewrite a statute. If we don't like this result, that's something for the legislature to deal with. That's something that they can do by changing the statute. But right now, what we have is a statute that says two times, in no event, can the hearing take place after 90 days. In no event. And that is the situation we're dealing with here.
Ms. Betts, can I move you on to talk about, just so we make sure we cover it with your client, about the questions I asked concerning this, you know, the three separate, I categorize them obviously, sure. But can you talk to the nature of them, whether they are matters of public concern in PTK's, you know, on y'all's side of it?
Sure, Your Honor. And you did ask that question exactly. What is the issue of public concern here? And that's the question, right? Because there isn't one. And that really highlights the gap in the evidence here. Because whose burden is it to show this is an issue of public concern? Well, that burden's Ms. Merrick's. That burden is hers to come to you and show you, I've made a communication about something of public concern. And that did not happen here, because there is absolutely no evidence in this record establishing what that book says, whether it addresses a public issue, whether the lawsuit was aimed at suppressing speech. That's just not in the record. The only evidence in the record is her own declaration that says nothing more than she wrote a book. She titled it Saving PTK, The Whistleblowers Fight for Truth and Change. She investigated issues with PTK and its internal governance. And she gathered information from former PTK employees and members through public records requests.
Well, what about Mr. Randazzo's claim that just news gathering itself is a matter of public concern?
First of all, Your Honor, this news gathering argument was waived. And it's the first time it was made by Ms. Merrick was in her reply brief in the trial court. In the Sanders case, Sanders versus Capitol, 1996 case tells us you can't raise for the first time in your reply brief an argument. And that is the first time she raises that argument. But even still, it fails for two reasons. And it's the same reason as the public concern issue fails, Your Honor. And that is because there is no evidence here. There's an evidentiary gap. How are we supposed to know that she's news gathering if we don't even know what she was news gathering about? We don't have any evidence of what that is. Her very thin statement that I was writing a book and it was about PTK's internal governance does not even tell us if it's fiction or fact. We don't know. And she's not provided any excerpts. She's not provided any copies or anything to anyone. And in fact, she even says in her declaration, I will never let anybody see an advance copy of my book. Presumably, that means even the trial court, because she didn't attach any copies of anything. So that means we have to take her word at it, that she was news gathering, that we have to take her word at it, that it was a matter of public concern, or her counsel's word, and that's all we have to rely on. This is a statute that is different than what the common law is, the American rule that we all pay our own way. She is trying to use this statute to get $500,000 in fees. And she's doing that without providing any evidence whatsoever that her book contained anything that would be even newsworthy or any matter of public concern. And in fact, if you look at the injunction that we were seeking, if you look at the declaratory judgment action we were seeking, it is very clear we were not asking her to be stopped from news gathering. We weren't asking for her to not be able to do public records requests, to not talk to former employees, to not file things in court. The only thing we were requesting is not to let her use our privileged materials and put that out there in the public world about a month or so before a jury trial that was set to go when she was in close contact with the opposing side of that case. That email is not a matter of public concern. If you read it, it is my client talking to a member of her board saying, I'm in the deposition right now about that lawsuit, which, by the way, was about a trade dress, wasn't about sexual harassment, wasn't about, you know, messing with students or anything like that. It was about a trade dress dispute, a business dispute, money. And my client is saying, here's an email we're going to use next in it. That's a privileged email. And that is not a matter of public concern. That is a private issue about a lawsuit that was between two entities that had nothing to do with anything that Ms. Merrick has alleged in this case is going to go into her book. There's just no way to frame it as public concern when you even listen to what she's saying, and certainly no evidence for her to meet her burden that this was ever a public concern, which she's required to do. And another point that's related to that is that she also has to show there's been a communication made. In order to get the protections, the extraordinary relief she requests under the TCPA, she has to show that it wasn't just a matter of public concern, it's a communication made about a public concern. Again, we don't have the book. There's no communication made. And this statute is using made in the past tense. Now, Ms. Merrick doesn't like that result. Again, that is a question for the legislature. How are we supposed to judge if this is a communication made about a public concern if it hasn't been made yet? The statute is written the way it is written for a reason, because we have to know what has been said to know whether or not we need to punish somebody for a lawsuit that they allegedly filed in retaliation for speech. If they haven't filed it in retaliation for speech, or if a communication hasn't been made, how could they be filing in retaliation for speech? And again, we're talking under the narrow confines of this TCPA. We're talking what the statute says. We're not talking about the broad First Amendment. We're talking about the TCPA says you can bring a lawsuit in these specific circumstances. And here, she has failed to meet her burden that there's been a communication made about a public concern. I say I'm out of time unless anyone has any questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate the time.
I'm a little stunned at the number of times we were accused of waiving arguments when half of this argument is an argument that was waived. But on the merits, the record shows that this whole issue of whether this email is privileged or not is a red herring. Okay, first, if you look at it, I don't think anybody would say that that's in any way privileged. But let's presume it was. The Pentagon Papers case was on top secret Pentagon files that the New York Times and Washington Post came into possession of. Now, state secrets about war strategy, you can't suppress those with a prior restraint. But here, they thought they could get a prior restraint on an entire book based on that email. And this argument that, well, it doesn't count under the TCPA because the communication hasn't been made, well, that's like that story about the kid who kills his parents and then throws himself at the mercy of the court for being an orphan. You got an injunction enjoining publication, and now you're saying, but now it's not published? Well, it's not published yet now, of course, because we don't know how it ends. We're going to find that out, I guess. If we look at Giles, upon which they rely, Giles is obviously different. Okay,
Let me ask a question. So you're saying we don't know how it ends, but do we even know that it's started? I mean, because nobody's seen...
Cutting you off right now.
Okay, thank you.
No, that's an example. I'm trying to demonstrate something. You were about to say something important.
Yeah, but I didn't.
Right, because I stopped you. Now, if I had done that in some way that was perhaps not demonstrative, I certainly hope I'd have been sanctioned for it.
So that could happen on any book that's not written?
Yes. I think if you are, as Justice Tiarina noted, even the news gathering here is protected. So pre-publication is protected. Okay. Otherwise, I mean, think of the TCPA is not the same breath as the First Amendment. It is far broader. Texas made a pronouncement that it is protecting free speech in a way that's a beacon to the other 49 states. So even the narrowest anti-SLAPP law, even a state without it wouldn't permit that kind of an injunction. Now here, where the TCPA clearly protects even more than the Constitution protects, it protects that news gathering and it protects that publication. Otherwise, what a great end run around it. We just have to go out and file injunctions against every newspaper if there's some kind of a scandal and say, don't publish anything about this. Doesn't count under the TCPA because it hasn't come out yet? I mean, that's just, it hurts my head to think about that kind of an argument. Now, Giles is markedly different. Okay, in Giles, it was ruled on late. Now, perhaps there might be a cute argument if I had had the misfortune to win at the lower court. Perhaps the court didn't have the authority to grant it, but I still think that that's a ridiculous argument because we have the whole point of the timing here is to end the case early. All right? It's the defendant who's supposed to complain if things aren't done quickly. Now, there is a theory that it also helps the plaintiff because the plaintiff needs to be able to move their case along. If you look at Giles, that was his whole point. He had multiple defendants, and the granting of the TCPA motion late impeded his ability to move his case forward with the other defendants. And then Walker, which again, we have this ellipsis problem. They eliminate the key point of what the court said about invited error. Okay, they said, we are not persuaded by this argument, referring to invited error, because it was Walker's error in failing to serve Clifford with the motion that necessitated rescheduling the hearing beyond the 90-day deadline to allow for such service. So this is not a situation like Walker. My client did everything right. And I know that you've seen this part of the record that shows this exchange. I mean, I can't believe that they're here arguing that we should have done things quicker when they did everything that they could to delay, delay, delay. The TCPA has a broad sweeping protection for freedom of expression, and it was not supposed to be in any way cabined by this theory that, you know, heads you win, tails you lose. There's nothing in the statute that says that we automatically lose if that deadline passes. How about we interpret it that we automatically win? There's just as much textual support for that. So why don't we do that? Especially when you see here that one side has, I think, comported themselves completely above board. And I can't say that for the opposition. Now, if we look at this discovery question, and I really don't feel like we should be descending all the way to that, but if we look at the issue of whether or not the lower court allowed discovery and what allowed means, and yes, I am relying on an interpretation of the word allowed from the Merriam-Webster dictionary that a dissenting judge cited, but still have respect for his view on this. Well, then what did the court do? Because the court was well aware of the deadlines. And the fact that we didn't file a motion, we were just communicating directly with the judge, I think is a non-issue. All right, we're communicating directly with the judge. The judge knows the deadlines. The judge knows that it can go to 120 days if he allows discovery. So what are we going to say about the judge? We can say something bad about the judge, that he just committed misconduct by knowing the deadlines and saying, I don't care. Well, I'm not ready to presume that. I'm going to presume that he implicitly allowed discovery. 120 days. But even if he didn't, there was no hearing. The judge considered it in chambers. I don't know when the judge did it. He said he was going to do it on the 18th. But what difference does it make? The whole point of this is to advance these cases, to either kill them early or let them move forward quickly. Now, if the judge made that decision and then issued his order and all of that fell within the 90 plus 30, in fact, there was some leeway there even, if he did it all within the 90 plus 30, where is the prejudice that the TCPA is examining? It's not there. This is just the most dishonorable way to try to derail this thing that I could have possibly imagined. So Ms. Merrick has a book ready to be published, and I really look forward to you writing the final chapter.
I have one last question. I mean, if we do find that it was heard on time, would the remedy be to send it back to the trial court for the fees determination? Would you expect that to happen at the appellate court level?
I would request that it happen at the appellate court level. That way we don't have to come back here. And I think that that would be proper, and we have briefed that, Justice Chiarina. If any of you have any other questions, I'm happy to answer. If not, 40 seconds on the table.
Nothing else, and this case will be under submission. Thank you.